So welcome everyone to this week's Core Volunteer Training. It's a weekly webinar program of Citizens Climate Lobbies that provides CCL supporters like you and I with access to in-depth training opportunities. And it provides the chance, especially for new-ish volunteers, to connect with each other and enhance their climate advocacy throughout the larger world. Tonight, we're going to be joined by CCL's research coordinator, Dana Nucatelli, for a special training on Dana's work assembling region-specific climate impact presentation slide decks. Now, these slide decks detail the most important climate change impacts for each of the seven regions, as defined by the National Climate Assessment Report, within the continental United States. Each slide is going to include, or each slide deck really, is going to include the scientific source references in the notes. Again, they're based on that fourth NCA report, as well as some of the updates that we've gotten from the most recent version of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change sixth assessment report. And again, these are the most comprehensive and authoritative assessments of the latest and greatest climate science research pertaining to the United States and the world. So the slide decks are intended to help us as CCL volunteers deliver local presentations about how climate change will impact people living in your area. The decks can be shortened, lengthened, expanded, otherwise modified as needed to meet the time constraints of the presentation event and the needs unique to each audience. And again, whether it be soaring temperatures, the growing number of wildfires, more frequent, stronger storms, pests affecting agriculture, sea level rise rather, communities around the world we know are dealing with the consequences of a warming planet. And so really the key goal tonight is highlighting a new resource we have to educating the public and calling attention to these local changes to help climate change and especially the impacts we're all experiencing feel more real for local constituents and answer the all important question, why should we care? So why should we care? The man that will help us get to that tonight is none other than the wonderful Dana Nucatelli. As I've highlighted, CCL's research coordinator. Dana is also an environmental scientist, climate journalist, and author of the book featured here on this slide, Climatology versus Pseudoscience. Dana has published 10 papers related to climate change in peer-reviewed journals, including three studies on the expert climate consensus. Dana has also written about climate science for a wide variety of outlets, including one of my favorites, Skeptical Science, The Guardian, and Yale Climate Connections. But before I pass it to Dana, I just wanted to highlight our three main learning goals. So if we've done our job well tonight, after our training, an hour together, we're going to have the chance for everyone to walk away with the following three areas of learning. Number one, introducing our new resource, these regional climate impact slide decks. We'll secondly outline the key climate impacts in each of the seven US regions and define how each of them are unique with particular climate impacts that we can help tell the story of and draw out in our presentations. And then Dana will also discuss how to use this new resource in addition to the suite of other local impact tools and resources that CCL Community provides in your own climate advocacy.
Cool, thanks Britt. That was a really good introduction to what we're talking about tonight with these regional climate impact slide decks. So you can see the seven different regions in the continental US on this map here, Southeast, Southern Great Plains, Southwest, Northwest, Northern Great Plains, Midwest, and Northeast. I haven't done decks for Alaska or Hawaii and the other islands, so that could potentially be done if there is demand for those, but I just haven't had time to get to that. So we're going to focus on these seven in the continental United States today. And so each of these regions has its own slide deck now. They are available in a Google Drive and you can get to them via community. And Britt, I think, is gonna share the link to that. Thanks, Britt. So you can see I also, on this Google Drive, there's a folder for video recordings. I made a video recording of myself delivering the presentation for each of these regional decks, just intended as sort of a training tool, because I'm hoping that people all around the country will give presentations themselves to their own regions. And so the videos just kind of give you an idea what I would say about each slide, and that the slides in the notes also include the sources of the information on each slide, like the scientific assessment reports or papers that the information is from. And then as Brett mentioned, you're encouraged to tailor the decks to meet whatever your needs are, because each event and presentation is unique. You're gonna have a different audience, different knowledge base for each audience, different time constraints. You know, you maybe only have 15 minutes, maybe you'll have a half hour, maybe you'll have an hour. And so you can tailor it and just kind of focus on the impacts and slides that are the most relevant to the audience that you're speaking to. When we talk about these climate change impacts, they're all very kind of negative and discouraging. And so we always try to couple them with also like positive solutions. So we're not just like totally discouraging the audience and leaving them despondent and depressed at the end of the talk. And so in all the slide decks, after all of the climate change impacts that I just outlined, I also have like, you know, the benefits of climate policy, how it's going to improve, you know, air quality and public health and crop yields and all this good stuff if we take action, and it's going to be like overall cheaper and benefit the economy. So it's, you know, we go to transitions from like all the bad stuff if we don't take action to like all the good stuff that happens, like all the win-win scenarios and, you know, benefits to health and longevity, people living longer, healthier lives and the economy doing better. And of course, we get the stable climate, which is what we really want. And so, yeah, it's really important that we don't just like hit the negatives and then leave it there. And so all the decks have regional specific benefits of climate policies too. And then beyond presentations, these decks and videos can also be used as resources for, you know, if you're going to write an LTE or an op-ed, you can weave in the local regional impacts from climate change to your area. Same thing, meeting members of Congress, you can talk to them about the most relevant climate impacts to their congressional district or state. If you're talking about municipal resolutions, endorsements, trying to get endorsers on board, meeting with editorial boards, or if you're just doing social media outreach, we just want it to be a useful resource that people can refer to and get information from. So as Brett mentioned, the main kind of the backbone resource behind these slide decks is the fourth National Climate Assessment Report, which was published in 2018, which is kind of like the United States version of the IPCC report. It's kind of like our scientists put together the latest and greatest summaries of climate science research that's been published relevant to the United States in recent years. So that's where that the map I showed in the beginning that breaks the country out in different regions, that's from this report. So that's why I used that particular regional breakout. And then also the IPCC sixth assessment report, which the first chunk of that, the working group one, which is called the physical science basis, was published last August. And then working group two just came out last week. About impacts, adaptation, and vulnerability. And then in April, working group three is coming out, which is going to talk about mitigation. So in April, I think April 27th, I'll be doing a CCU, maybe it's 21st. Some Thursday in April, I'll be doing a CCU about these different IPCC reports. So that's kind of the second. It's more of a general resource. It's not, you know, regional specific to the US. So it's just kind of talking about general climate change impacts that pertain to these regions but are less specific. And then, of course, I used a bunch of individual papers and other resources too. So now I'm going to go through some of the slides. I'm going to jam through them real quick just for the sake of time, so you guys can just get a flavor of what these slides were going to look like. So this is kind of the first one that I use in a lot of, I think in every deck. This is just kind of like a general description of how climate change impacts extreme weather events. Which we know that we burn fossil fuels, we put carbon dioxide in the air, which as greenhouse gas traps more heat. And so that causes temperatures to rise, which causes more evaporation of water from the soil, which then creates drier conditions in regions that are prone to droughts or heat waves or wildfires. It worsens those kinds of events by drying out the soil. And then conversely, a hotter atmosphere holds more water vapor. So in regions that are prone to heavy rainfall and flooding events, that increase in the amount of water in the atmosphere exacerbates extreme precipitation and flooding events in those particular regions. So, you know, some of these might be relevant to some regions and some of them might be relevant to other regions, depending on the particular weather types of events that happen in each individual region. And then this map, I think I've gotten almost every deck because it's really useful in illustrating that point of the difference in different regions. So this is a change in average rainfall across the United States over the last 30 years. So it's really interesting. You can basically split the country down the middle, and the eastern half of the country is almost entirely gotten wetter. That's the bluish greenish color as an increase in precipitation over the past 30 years. And then the western half is almost entirely gotten drier. That's the yellow brownish color. And so you can see kind of in the west, we're more worried about things like droughts and wildfires, and then the east were more worried about things like heavy precipitation and flooding. Now we're going to go quickly region by region, starting with the southeast, which is kind of all these chunk of southern states. And so the main impacts in the southeast are flooding and hurricanes and extreme heat. And it's actually the most vulnerable region to climate change impacts, which is why I'm going to start with it. So one impact we have to worry about is extreme heat. And this is from the fourth climate assessment report. So basically days above 95 degrees maximum temperature and nighttime minimums that don't go below 75 degrees Fahrenheit are going to become more and more frequent as temperatures continue to rise. And what is now very rare, days above 100 degrees and nights that don't go below 80 degrees are going to become relatively commonplace depending on how much global warming we allow to occur in the future. And so that's kind of really dangerous conditions because it can cause all kinds of heat stress and heat strokes and hospitalizations and things like that. So these are just a couple of charts where you can see the different scenarios. This is like a worst case scenario over here on the top, in the middle of the century and end of the century of days that are going there, these nights that are don't get cooler than 75 degrees, and you can see the number of nights. I'm not going to dwell on that, but if you want to look in more detail, again, you can go to the slides and my videos talking about this. And then with extreme heat comes lost work hours, especially for people who are working outside and things like construction and agriculture. So in a worst case scenario, this is what this is showing. It's kind of a worst case scenario, lots and lots of global warming by the end of the century. You can see kind of all this red is between like a 3 to 6.5% loss in labor hours due to this extreme heat. And so you can see in the South particularly and in the Midwest, but especially in the deep South, like Southern Texas and Florida, becomes a really, really big problem. And you lose a lot of labor hours and economic impacts as a result. There's also sea level rise is a big problem for the Southeast. We've already seen 9 inches globally of sea level rise, and we're expecting to see another 4 to 6 inches over the next decade because of this acceleration that we're seeing in sea level rise. The East Coast, especially, and the Gulf Coast, are seeing between 10 to 18 inches because they have a combination of both rising sea levels and sinking land. And so they have a particularly high rate of sea level rise because of this combination of sinking land and rising oceans. And then there's a lot of uncertainty going out to 2100 because we don't know how fast these big ice sheets might collapse. So we could be looking at up to 5 feet by 2100, depending on that. But there's a lot of uncertainty the further we go out. So as a result, Louisiana is losing a lot of coastal land, coastal wetlands, and we're seeing a lot of increased tidal flooding along the coast. And there's some slides about that that I won't go into today. So as I mentioned, it's the country's most vulnerable region. So we've got some maps here from a study that was published in 2017, looking at a few different climate change impacts. This is agricultural yields. So again, you have really high heat that is bad for a lot of different crop yields. And so you can see the kind of reddish colors in the South, especially and in the Midwest, as temperatures get really high, has this adverse effect on crop yields. You also have a lot of mortality as a result of too much heat. So you have heat deaths, premature deaths, especially again in the southeastern region, and also in this region we talked about, that was the Southern Great Plains. We'll get to that next. Energy expenditures, because the hotter it is, the more energy you have to use for air conditioning. And so you have to spend a lot of money on this extra energy for air conditioning, again, in the Southeast and the Southern Great Plains states. Basically, the closer you are to the equator, the hotter it is, and the more impact these rising temperatures have on those kinds of air conditioning energy expenditures. And you're also in a hurricane zone along the Gulf Coast here on the East Coast. And so you have all this damage from worsening hurricanes. And so you put that all together. This is the total damages from the impacts considered in this paper, which is not every climate change impact. It's kind of those heat, agriculture, hurricanes, and sea level rise are the main ones. And so you can see those really hit the Southeast and the Southern Great Plains really hard. You're talking about between 10 to 25 plus percent of GDP in these orange to red counties by the end of the century in a worst case scenario. So again, we can mitigate this by slowing climate change, but you can see it is the most vulnerable region with kind of the most orange and red colors from these various damaging climate change impacts. So then the other one that we saw a lot of orange and red there was the Southern Great Plains, which is your Texas, Oklahoma, and Kansas. So they have very similar impacts, flooding, drought, and heat waves, also hurricanes in Texas. Extreme heat is a really tough one, especially in Texas. So this is looking at the number of days above 100 degrees in various parts of Texas. So you can see kind of the further you get from the coast, the hotter it is there. And they've been in every region, the number of 100 degree days has already been increasing. And so it's expected to nearly double by 2036 compared to last decade or two, and just getting more and more of these 100 degree plus days, especially in urban areas where there's a lot of concrete and cement and buildings that hold in heat. And so this is a nice projection of the number of days over 100 degrees in this region. Again, you can see Southern Texas, especially because again, you're getting further south, closer to the equator. And so it's really, really hot there. And so worst case scenario, you see a lot of days. You're talking about 3+ months additional above 100 degrees in this worst case scenario. This is kind of the scenario that we're on track for right now. It's kind of business as usual, where you get still about a month plus of number of days additional above 100 degrees than you have currently. Drought is also a problem in the Southern Great Plains states. So this is from a nice paper published a few years ago looking at drought projections out to the future. So this is kind of historical drought. This is drought risk in the future down here. We're right about here right now. So, and then down here, we're looking at the risk of a drought lasting less than a decade and then the risk of a drought lasting multiple decades, which is really, really damaging because that, you know, basically really, really drying things out and it's really hard for agriculture to persists when things or conditions are consistently dry every year for multiple decades. And so you see like the risk of this multi-decadal drought was really low in the last century and toward the end of the century. And this is a business as usual scenario. It's actually quite a lot higher. And right now, drought risks in a current policy scenario become larger than at any time in the past millennium in the Southern Great Plains region because higher temperatures cause more evaporation, which dries things out. Then we got hurricanes. So I took some information from the IPCC report on hurricanes, which concluded that the proportion of major hurricane intensities and the frequency of rapid intensification of hurricanes, so hurricanes really quickly going from like a weak storm to a strong hurricane, have increased globally over the past few decades. The translation speed, which is how fast they move across the ocean or land, is slowed down too, which seems to be related to climate change. So that's a big problem when you have hurricanes, like for example, Hurricane Harvey kind of stalled over the Houston area and just dumped rain on the Houston area for days on end and caused really damaging flooding. So at 1.5 degrees Celsius, the IPCC estimates 10% more hurricanes will reach the worst, strongest categories of 4 to 5. At 2 degrees, that becomes 13%. And at 4 degrees, that will become 20%. Which doesn't sound like too much more, but when you consider like there's only 10 to 20 named storms every year, you know, that's like one or two more every year. And then, you know, it's like adding another bullet to your Russian roulette gun. Like it's, you don't know where those hurricanes are going to go, where their tracks are going to go, but, you know, adds the risk of them hitting a populated area and doing a lot of damage. So then in the Southwest, that's my region, we get to worry about wildfires and heat and drought as our worst climate change impacts. California also has sea level rise, but that's just along our coast. So there was a really good study just published on the Southwestern drought, looking at the latest 22-year period compared to the past 1,200 years, similar periods, and found that it was the driest in that entire record that they were able to reconstruct. So we're in the middle of our worst drought in over 1,000 years, and the study estimated that human-caused climate change made those conditions about 42% more intense than it would have been naturally. So we would have had kind of a modest drought and human-caused climate change because the increase in heat, increased dryness, really intensified that drought. And they concluded that the current drought would not have been on a mega drought trajectory in terms of the severity of duration without human-caused climate change. And in fact, it wouldn't have even just been a single extended 22-year drought without human-caused climate change, because somewhere in that 22-year period, we would have had kind of wet enough conditions that it would have kind of created a break in the current constant drought that we've been in the middle of. But because of that additional heat and dryness, we are in this kind of record multi-decade drought right now. And then we got wildfires. So I put together this chart myself from data from CAL FIRE, looking at the acreage burned in California since 1987, which is when we had started to have good records. So you can see a lot of year-to-year variability, but this is the long-term trend going up and up and up, as on average, wildfires get worse and worse and worse, especially the past 4 years, three of them being the three worst wildfire seasons on record. These last two being particularly crazy. And then this is from the National Climate Assessment Report again. So this is taking some information from a 2016 study looking at the cumulative area burned in Western wildfires, how much would it burn without climate change? And then the orange is the additional area that burned because of human-caused climate change, again, because of the increased heat and dryness caused by our rising temperatures. And so what they concluded was that human-caused climate change doubled the area that burned or that would have burned otherwise without human-caused climate change. So we got a multiple of two more forests and other land burning because of climate change. And really important for us in the Southwest is our shrinking snowpack, because that's a really key source of water. And so both the Sierra Nevada and Rocky Mountain snowpacks are really important for refilling our reservoirs in the summer months when we're not getting much of any rain. But of course, those snowpacks are shrinking for two main reasons, because we're getting less precipitation falling as snow, more as rain, as temperatures are not cold enough to form snow as often. And the snowpack is also melting earlier in the year because temperatures are hotter earlier in the year, in the spring months. And so the snowpack just doesn't last as long. And so once we get into the summer and all the snow is melted, then we don't have that source of water anymore. So far, the Sierra Nevada snowpack has shrunk 25% and is projected to decline 50 to 90% or so, depending on how much future global warming we allow to happen. And so that's a threat of water shortages throughout the region, which is in particular important for California agriculture, which produces a whole lot of food for the country and the world. And then we have the Northwest, Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, which also has very similar shrinking snowpack problems, which since I covered it in the last slide, I won't cover it for the Northwest, but they also have these various stressed natural resources that they have to worry about. So for example, they have a lot of really nice forests in the Northwest, but they're facing the same kind of drought problem as the Southwest and also the same kind of shrinking snowpack. And so that lack of water creates water stress for the trees. And of course, they're getting more heat waves as temperatures rise. And so that can also add heat stress for the trees, worsening wildfires, just like in the Southwest, we're getting worsening wildfires in the Northwest. So obviously wildfires, burning forests, endangers those trees again. And we're also seeing more bark beetle outbreaks because when you have warmer winters, that means fewer bark beetles die out in the winter, more of them survive. And so they expand further when it gets into the warm season. And recent studies have shown that bark beetles have killed 7% of the Western forested area over the past 34 years. This is kind of like what a bark beetle track through a tree looks like. They call them bark beetle galleries. And the problem is they cut off the nutrient flow through the tree, and so then they can kill trees in that way. Drought makes trees especially susceptible to bark beetles because their defense is they make like a waxy resin and chemicals that kind of block the beetles from making these galleries. But when they're stressed, then the trees don't have the resources to devote to making those defenses. And so that's one problem. And then the other problem is when you have higher temperatures, the beetles, as I mentioned, they survive more in the winter and they also reach reproductive age sooner and produce more offspring. And so they just kind of spread more than they would otherwise have when temperatures are hotter. And there was just a study last year estimating that for each degree Celsius we get of warming, that increases the number of trees killed by these bark beetles by 20%. If you couple that with a drought, that number increases 35 to 40%. And so higher temperatures are really creating this problem of bark beetles doing a lot of damage to forests. And then when we have these wildfires going through forests, that creates the problem of wildfire smoke. So this is a really cool map showing the number of days that each county in the US was exposed to wildfire smoke. This first map is from a relatively mild set of wildfire seasons from 2009 to 2013. So you can see like in the Northwest, you're kind of looking at mostly this kind of orangish color. So, you know, maybe 30 days, 20 to 30 days of the year where they were exposed to wildfire smoke. But then if you look at kind of a recent five-year period when we had a really bad set of wildfire seasons, you can see now we've got lots of purple So then you're looking at, you know, 50 to 60 days, so close to 2 months of the year when these counties were exposed to wildfire smoke, which recent research has shown is particularly harmful for public health when people breathe in this wildfire smoke. There's a lot of junk in it, and it does a lot of damage and creates a lot of hospitalizations and asthma and all kinds of health problems. So next one is the Northern Great Plains, which is kind of from Montana to the Dakotas and Nebraska and also Wyoming. Their main problems are weather instability and agriculture when it comes to climate change. So heat and rising carbon dioxide have a variety of impacts on agriculture. When you have extreme heat during pollination and grain fill periods, that reduces crop yields. Plants or crops tend to not like extreme heat. You also get an expansion of weeds and invasive species and pests as kind of the warm temperatures go further and further to the north into this region, making the climates suitable for those different species. You do get longer growing seasons, which is kind of beneficial because these are relatively cold states. And so as temperatures rise, they do get some benefit of longer growing season. And also some crops do benefit from what we call CO2 fertilization. So, you know, we often hear people say CO2 is plant food, which there is some truth to that. Some crops do benefit from CO2 fertilization. On the other hand, there is less water reliability because this particular region is really already has kind of unstable weather. It tends to shift from droughts to floods pretty frequently. And so both of those droughts and floods are going to worsen in a climate change world. And so that poses challenge to agriculture when you have this increasingly unreliable weather in a region that already has relatively unreliable weather. And also the kind of forage quality of grasses decreases as temperatures get higher. And so that's, you know, this particular region is like the largest remaining rangeland ecosystem in the country. And so when the quality of the kind of nutritional content of the grass decreases, that poses a problem. So then you have to have more and more grasses for the livestock to eat. And then you get droughts and floods, kind of complicating the issue. So I mentioned this is a region that's already prone to kind of droughts and floods shifting back and forth. And they're going to see precipitation patterns shift even further. So they're expected to see more rain in the winter and spring months, less rain in the summer months, especially the higher warming you get. You get the shifting in precipitation patterns. And then, as I mentioned, because you have more water vapor in the atmosphere, you get more extreme precipitation when it does rain. You get like up to 10% more intense extreme precipitation events, intensity, and up to 50% more frequency in extreme precipitation events by the middle of the century. And there's some recent research showing that the changes in precipitation patterns can have a really disruptive effect on the economy in a variety of different ways, both with flooding and just with an increased number of wet days and things like that, that can really have bad impacts on economic growth in a variety of different ways. And there's a lot of outdoor recreation in these Northern Great Plains states, a lot of like fishing and hunting and camping and things like that. Also snow activities in the Rocky Mountains, but the snowpack is going to shrink there too, just like in the Sierra Nevadas and in the Northwestern states. And that shrinking snowpack also leads to less water runoff into rivers and streams, especially in the late summer. So that's a problem for river recreation, fishing and things like that. It then shifts the habitat suitability because you're also getting warmer water as temperatures rise. And so it's really a problem for cold water fish species that are, you know, adapted to a certain temperature of water and the temperature's rising. And so that's a problem for cold water fishing, which is a very valuable industry for these states. And it's already creating problems, making these cold water fish species vulnerable to diseases like proliferative kidney disease, for example. So we're already seeing some of those impacts. And then over to the Midwest, which is kind of going from Minnesota, Iowa, and Missouri all the way over to Michigan and Ohio. So their main impacts are in agriculture and extreme heat and biodiversity species loss. So this is a nice map I've got in a bunch of the different slide decks, because what we're looking at is basically anything that's not dark blue is a county that has a significant proportion of its land devoted to agriculture. And so you can really clearly see the heavy agricultural activity in the Midwestern states here. with most of the counties at having different colors. You can even see some like of this kind of reddish, which is like 80% of the land in those counties is used to for agriculture. It's primarily in the Midwest, corn and soybeans. It's almost combined $50 billion annual agricultural revenue generation. And then also wheat and oats get another $3 billion or so agriculture generation, but it's mostly corn and soybeans in the Midwest. But climate change and especially heat, but also changing precipitation is really bad for corn and soybeans in particular. There's been a variety of studies that project a 5 to 10% reduction in corn yields per degree Celsius of warming that we see. Again, drought and excess rain have in the past been the primary contributors to crop losses in the Midwest. But as temperatures rise, we expect for corn that heat will be the biggest factor in their declining yields. For soybean, it may still be changes in precipitation that are most important, but climate change also affects precipitation patterns. So those are both a problem for those crop yields. And we have the same problem with warmer winters, allowing pest populations to kind of grow and expand further to the north, also crop pathogens, and those will have adverse effects, impacts on crop yields too. And then we've got the heat waves in cities in particular are problems. This is a nice chart from the Fourth Assessment Report, looking at days above 100 degrees in Chicago, which is not adapted to that extreme heat. You can see right here, there's been almost no days above 100 degrees Fahrenheit in Chicago, at least a few decades ago. Now we're starting to get a few of them. And as it gets hotter and hotter, you start to see more. So this one, the red is kind of our worst case scenario. The blue is kind of our current business as usual scenario. So you can see business as usual, we get about a week of days above 100 degrees Fahrenheit in Chicago. In the worst case scenario, you get maybe 3 weeks, but there's a lot of uncertainty there. So, you know, it starts to be that Chicago starts to look more like Las Vegas in terms of the extreme heat in a worst case scenario and potentially 2,000 additional heat deaths per year. Again, in that worst case scenario, which we are probably going to avoid, but nevertheless, it's a big risk if we kind of backslide in our climate policies that we could start to see these really big impacts in terms of heat in northern cities. And then we're also seeing, so species have to adapt and they try to adapt by kind of shifting northward in latitude and upslope to where temperatures used to be cooler. To try to, you know, stay in the same temperature range, but it's hard for them to necessarily shift their locations fast enough. And so we're looking at here, again, from the National Climate Assessment Report, this one in the middle with the red arrows is how the climate conditions have changed. So like what used to be the climate conditions in kind of southern Wisconsin is now the climate conditions of kind of central Wisconsin. And on the left side here, you can see how species have shifted, and these are understory plants. So they're plants kind of on the floor underneath the canopy of forests. And so they have tried to shift. They've kind of been shifting in the right direction, but just not enough. Like they haven't been able to keep up with the rapid change in the climatic conditions. And so this blue one here, you can see is the difference in the change in the climate versus how much they have moved. And so they have not moved far enough north into the west. And so basically they're not able to keep up with how fast the climate is changing. And then that causes potential loss of species and biodiversity loss and potential species extinctions. And then last region we got is the Northeast, which mostly has to worry about changes in water associated with flooding and fisheries, and also some concerns with heat waves. So this is a chart from a recent report that that's actually in a bunch of different decks too. For different regions, what we're looking at is average annual losses from flooding in each county. So if it's this dark red, it's more than a $25 million annual flooding cost in those counties. And so you can see in the Northeast in particular, there's a lot of these dark red counties where they've already been seeing these really large annual flooding losses, flooding costs. Oops. And then this next one is how much those flooding losses are projected to increase over the next 30 years. And so again, a dark green is an increase of more than $5 million per year in annual flooding cost. And again, you can see in this Northeastern region, there's a lot of this dark green, meaning that they are going to be the most vulnerable to increased flooding costs, mostly from rising sea levels, also because you got hurricanes coming in and creating storm surges. They also have been seeing shifting species in the Atlantic Ocean. You can see over here, this is kind of the latitude of where the species have been. So like lobsters have been moving further and further to the north. So black sea bass, Atlantic cod were already very far to the north, so they haven't been able to adapt because they haven't had much further north to move. And so as a result, the cod population has declined really fast. The black sea bass has kind of replaced it. The lobster in the southern part of New England have really declined rapidly, while in the northern part of the Gulf of Maine, they've actually increased, combination of kind of a shift of populations further to the north, and they've actually had kind of better, more sustainable lobstering practices in the Gulf of Maine too. Okay, so that's kind of all the regional slides that I'm going to illustrate today, because I want to leave plenty of time for questions. But we're going to have these available on the CCL community, which has lots of different local impact resources. So we're going to share the link to that. So you go, basically you can go to the resources button and local impacts and explore the various different pages. We have different tools and explainers and stuff like that for looking at these different regional impacts, good resources to use. And then one other thing we wanted to plug is that we are very soon going to have a page on the CCL community website that is going to be a place for our science and economics and policy nerds to kind of hang out, and a one-stop shop for all our research team's resources, including like tools and trainings. We're gonna have a discussion forum. We're gonna do a chart of the week that will hopefully stimulate some good discussions. All our research blogs and articles, and we may end up doing some kind of research team specific newsletters at some point. So it's going to be like kind of a really nice resource for the research team and for folks who are interested in the research that we're doing to kind of conglomerate and discuss among ourselves and share our resources and questions and discussions.
You can also find at the bottom of any training page now a little log your training button, and that will help signal the impact of all of these trainings across our network. You can also just go directly to the action tracker, click on chapter and volunteer development, and then under training, type in any of the ones that you might want to do right here. And just a huge round of applause for Dana and all the work that you've put into condensing down all of the different regional reports from the NCA into these accessible slide decks. I know that we're all really looking forward to trying them out locally. And so I just really wanted to plug the appreciation I think all of us share on the actual call tonight. And for those that aren't tuning in live, but will benefit from them later on. We just wanted to obviously thank you for making it to tonight's presentation. If you have any questions for Dana, dana.nucitelli at Citizens Climate, he'll put that in the chat for you. You can also follow Dana with his many wonderful Twitter thread explainers on Twitter at dana1981. And then if you have any ongoing questions, we can route those towards Dana, and we hope you are safe and well, found tonight's training empowering, and look forward to hearing how you use it in your community, everyone. Stay safe, everyone.
You too. Thank you. Take care.
Thanks, Dana. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Citizens Climate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration.
Like what you hear? Recommend us to your friends and make sure to give us a 5-star rating. It helps us show up on other listeners' feeds. Feel free to pass on any suggestions for future episodes in the comments as well.
And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.